Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani on IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for you today. My guest today is Sarah Romeo White. She is a writer and blogger, and she just released her BingeMyStory.com story about her life. And it's really quite extraordinary. It's her struggle with her eating disorder, and she is on, brave as could be, to share that with all of us. And I'm really thrilled to have her on. But before we get to Sarah, I wanted to share with all of you some of the things going on in and around our city and the world, and some things you can go to and some things you can take action on. This past Tuesday night, we had a screening of the new movie Fed Up, which is the movie that Katie Couric is narrating. And it, you know, came out nationally in many theaters across the country this past week. And if you can get yourself to it and anybody to it, I highly suggest you do. It's, you know, not dealing with some of the issues of GMOs or fracking or some of those other important issues. It's just talking about real food. And it's talking about sugar, and it's talking about Americans' addiction to sugar and how it's been a calculated manipulation on the parts of food manufacturers to create food that we are addicted to. And so that when a lot of people have these struggles with addiction and being addicted to food, a lot of it is intentional on the parts of the food manufacturers. The same way the tobacco companies intentionally put things into cigarettes to make us addicted, well, they're doing the same thing with our food, and it's a calculated manipulation to get the American people fat. And it was really a very powerful movie. Marion Nestle in the film actually said, you know, that it's good business for most businesses to have the American people fat and unhealthy. It's good for food manufacturers to get us to eat as much as possible. It's good for farmers that are growing crops that are subsidized, meaning corn, soy, canola, and cotton. It's good for pharmaceutical companies. It's good for hospitals, for doctors. It's good for business. The people it's not good for is us. It's not good for the public. And unfortunately, our government and the people that are supposed to be protecting us have their hands open to donations from these big corporations. And so they want to keep those big corporate guys happy. And they don't care so much about us. So one of the things that came out of this movie was how we all have to get really pissed. And we all have to mobilize and get together and create a movement, a big, massive uprising against food manufacturers and food companies that are manipulating our food like this. They actually hired the same PR people that the tobacco companies hired to mislead us and to mislead the public. And so it's a really powerful movie. I really recommend people getting out to see it. It's being shown the rest of this week at the Cinema Arts Center. And just a little plug for the Cinema Arts Center. I have to say that this is our local community arts cinema. It's in Huntington. It's about a half an hour from me. I don't live near there, but I really try to go there regularly, and I am there regularly just because they are the home for our Slow Food Monthly meetings, which happen the second Tuesday of every month. They are home for so many great progressive films, art films, documentary films that really share information that we all need to know. As a matter of fact, in addition to Fed Up, this week and next week, this Sunday on June 1st, they are having a screening of Take Back Your Power, Investigating the Smart Grid. And this is a film by Josh Del Sol, the filmmaker, and he actually will be there following the film for a Q&A session. But this film, Take Back Your Power, investigates the erosion of the rights that to all of us in the name of smart and green. And I think these, I don't know that much about it, so I'm looking forward to going to this movie, but I think these smart grids that they put into people's homes gives them the ability to know what we're doing inside our houses, what our computers are doing, and to read not just our electric usage, but other types of usage too. So it's supposed to be a very good film, and if you are in the Long Island area, it's at the Cinema Arts Center on Sunday, June 1st from 7:30 to 9. And there's a reception following the Q&A. But that's what our community cinema does, and it's actually member-supported, so you can join this cinema. And like I said, they are home not only to our organization, Slow Food Huntington, which soon will become Slow Food North Shore. It's also home to many other organizations. All the time when I go there, I see other groups meeting in their cafe, and they have a really nice, healthy cafe. They serve organic popcorn, organic butter, and it's just a really good place to go and hang out. Some other things going on in around the city this week. Let's see, tonight is Brooklyn Uncorked, which is being sponsored by Edible Brooklyn, and it's become one of the most popular events in New York City to kick off the summer. And you can join other Edible Brooklyn communities for an evening of great sipping of wine and awarding cocktails and feasting on some of the finest fare that will be donated by some great restaurants. So that takes place at the Skylight One Hanson, at One Hanson Place in Brooklyn from 6 to 9 tonight. I believe there's still tickets left. You can either Google Brooklyn Uncorked or go to Edible Brooklyn and find out information about that. Also this Sunday, and the first Sunday of every month throughout the growing season, Restoration Farm will be hosting a Tin House music event. And they have a new tin house on their farm, and they will be having live music all summer long. And it starts at 2 o'clock with an open mic, and then at 3 o'clock the performance comes on, and it goes till around 5. And Restoration Farm is on Round Swamp Road in Old Bethpage. Great, great community, great CSA. Dan and Carolyn, the farmers who run it, are really wonderful people. And so come on down and meet some of your local community. It's really a fun time. June 5th, Slow Food New York City is having their third annual fundraiser, and that will be supporting Slow Food New York City's Urban Harvest Program, and you can find out more information about that on Slow Food New York City's website. June 11th, Dan Barber and Ira Glass will be speaking at the 92nd Street Y, Beyond Farm to Table and a New Food Revolution. And following that, Dan Barber will be signing copies of his new book, The Third Plate. I went and saw Michael Pollan speak there a few weeks back, and it was really a great space. It was actually my first time being there, so I highly recommend that. That's June 11th from 8 to 10 p.m. And that's what's going on right now. I'll be starting my cooking classes again, starting every other Wednesday beginning July 9th, and setting those up now as to what the focus will be of each of the classes. But basically, my garden's late getting in, so that's why I'm late starting the sessions this year. But my cooking classes are farm-to-table cooking classes where we'll harvest vegetables right from the garden and then cook them into some delicious fare. They go from 6 to 9, so we first, or 6:30 to 9:30. So we harvest the vegetables and then we will cook and sit down to a large family table and all share the meal together. So that's a really great, great time and a great opportunity to learn some of my cooking techniques and favorite recipes, and it's great. So if you can join us for that, I'd love to meet you all and have you come down. Before I invite Sarah on, I want to share a recipe with all of you. Also, I wanted to actually just touch on a few things that are going on in the news that I almost forgot to talk to you about. I think you've probably all heard that the Republicans, in the agriculture department are trying to introduce a new policy that is going to allow school districts that can't seem to afford introducing healthier foods into schools to go back to business as usual. And right now, there's been a lot of work done both with Michelle Obama and the Senior Policy Advisor for Nutrition Policy, Sam Cass, who's the chef at the White House. They've been really making inroads into improving the school lunch program. And this House Republican bill, the Agriculture Appropriations Bill, would really set that back and will allow schools that are struggling to comply with the mandates to reduce salt, fat, and calories and introduce whole grains, lean proteins, and produce to the National School Lunch Program. They are trying to give them a little window of backing out of that. And so you know those are going to be the school districts that need it most. These are going to be the school districts that have a majority of students on free and reduced lunch programs. They're going to be the school districts where the kids really struggle to have good food at home. And these are the kids that are going to be really hurt by this. So please go onto my website under In the News, and there's a place where you can take action, sign a petition to keep that bill from being passed in the House. And one thing that also came out of this movie with Fed Up is just how important it is for us all to get involved. And I know I talk about this every week, but I cannot share with you enough how important it is for all of us to get involved in some topic. There are so many issues that need repair out there. And I know we all can't do all of them, but we all can do some of them. And so just pick at least one to really pour your heart into and get involved. So another one is to label GMOs. I mean, the New York Times did a survey back in 2013. 93% of respondents want genetically modified ingredients to be labeled. 93%. More than 1.4 million people signed the Center for Food Safety's petition urging the federal agency to require GMO labeling. However, we still don't have that. And again, it's because of the open hands and for the big donations that these food manufacturers and pharmaceutical companies and biotech companies give to the politicians. And we need to change that. We need to change these donations so that big corporations cannot make these kind of donations, so that our elected officials who we elect are going to do what we want and not do what big corporations want. We need to turn this around. And so GMO labeling is important for so many reasons, but transparency and having the right to know is so important. Last weekend, there was the March Against Monsanto on Saturday, and that was such a big happening. There was, you know, in over, I don't know how many countries, but in, you know, around the world, there was a march against Monsanto. And the New York Times reported, you know, that in a few dozen cities, there were marches against Monsanto. But there was actually marches all across the world. And it was of more than 400 cities across 52 countries. I mean, that's a lot. And for it to be reported on in the New York Times as a few dozen is just despicable. But anyway, it's just showing how many people across the world really want to get Monsanto out of our food and get these GMOs out of our food and at least have the right to know. So we need everybody to take action. There's going to be a huge, huge rally September 20th and 21st. Being sponsored by 350.org. Bill McKibben just wrote a great article and a formal invitation to this event for Rolling Stone magazine. So you can actually find a link to that on my website as well at iegreen.com. But it's going to be a huge rally. In September, there's going to be a huge summit on climate change. And it's going to be a huge gathering of people from all different countries coming here talking about climate change, and we want a huge demonstration to take place in New York City that weekend. So please mark your calendars now, block it out, September 20th and 21st. for this march, and I'll certainly be sharing more information with you as we get closer. We also want to stop the Environmental Protection Agency from allowing Agent Orange to be used even more on our crops. Dow company has used Agent Orange, and as a result of putting these into our foods or into our genetically modified crops, we are spraying more and more pesticides and herbicides on our crops than we've ever used before. And instead of it reducing the amount of pesticides and herbicides we need to use, it's increased it. So we need to really, again, get involved, get Agent Orange out of our food supply, and just get involved and become knowledgeable. I mean, I was shocked to find out that Scott's grass seed, which is, seems like the most benign thing, they're trying to make that GMO'd. Can you imagine if our grass-fed cows, the highest quality meats that people can buy, are now going to be grazing on GMO grass? I mean, then you get secondhand contamination, and it's just terrible. So you really need to get involved before everything in our food supply gets affected. So check out the articles on my website at iegreen.com. Feel free to send me any comments, and I will respond to you. Okay, so now I want to share with you this recipe so I can invite Sarah back on. This is a very simple side dish, but so easy and delicious. Pomegranate molasses and maple syrup glazed sweet potatoes. By cutting the sweet potatoes into cubes, it allows you to cook them much quicker. I use 6 sweet potatoes. It's good for 6 to 8 people. You cut them into cubes, 1/4 cup of olive oil, only 1 tablespoon of maple syrup and 1 tablespoon of the pomegranate molasses, because the sweet potatoes are already so sweet. And then I use 2 tablespoons of orange juice, 1 teaspoon of cinnamon, and 1/2 teaspoon of salt. And I preheat my oven to 400 degrees. I line a baking sheet with parchment paper, and that saves a lot on the cleanup, because sweet potatoes without anything can be really sticky and hard to clean up. But with the molasses and the maple syrup cooking into the pan, really is horrible to clean up. So line your baking sheet with some parchment paper. Toss the sweet potatoes with the olive oil, the maple syrup, the pomegranate molasses, the orange juice, cinnamon, and salt. Excuse me. And bake for 45 minutes until soft. And that is it. Very simple, very easy, and delicious. Okay. So now it's my pleasure to invite Sarah Romeo White on. As I said, she is a blogger who has just written her memoir at bingemystory.com, and it's a multimedia account of her lifelong struggle with a binge eating disorder. She's also a writer and lives with her husband and 2 cats in Los Angeles, and right now she blogs at bingemyblog.tumblr.com. So, Sarah, are you with us?
Yes, hi.
Hi. Welcome, and thank you for being willing to wake up so early in L.A. to be on our show.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Sure. So, I read most of Binge My Story, and it's just, such a honest, heart-wrenching, touching story of your struggle. And I was wondering if you could share with everybody who's listening what you what it was like, or what you feel like the root cause of your eating disorder was.
Mm-hmm. I think that it's hard to pinpoint a specific thing, because I think with any form of addiction or eating disorder that there's a lot of different causes. I think for me, I think genetics definitely played a factor, just because of, the history in my family. I come from a, history of addiction and food issues. But I also think that when I look back at it and I can think of timing-wise, I started binging really early. I was about 7 years old when my disorder kind of started. And I at the same time, I was dealing with some traumas and abuses in my childhood. So I really kind of, if I needed to pinpoint it to one thing, I think that that was kind of the catalyst of using food as a way to cope with dealing with the abuses and things that I was going through at that time, just as a child. I mean, I think at any age that could happen, but definitely as a child and just not having any, you know, tools or any even idea of what is going on, that you just kind of latch on to what makes you feel better the quickest, and then it just kind of spirals from there.
Uh-huh. And how quick was your weight gain, or how gradual? Like, you know, how, at what point did you realize something was wrong?
I think my weight gain, I guess, was gradual in the beginning, but I was overweight by the time I was in, you know, third grade. So I guess maybe pretty quickly. I mean, I didn't get to the point of being, you know, morbidly obese until I was in my late teens. And I think that at that point, you know, I guess in high school was when, yeah, maybe even earlier than that was when we really knew that there was a problem. Because I, you know, I didn't just suffer from eating disorders. I had a lot of different at the time I was being diagnosed with all different mental illnesses. I, when I reflect back on it, think that it was more PTSD and just also general things that adolescents
go through.
Post-traumatic stress disorder.
From what?
From the trauma of my childhood, from sexual abuses and physical abuses in my childhood. So I think that was more of what was going on. I mean, I was diagnosed as bipolar, had anxiety disorder, depression. I was on every medication you could imagine from the time I was 13. So, and I'd been in therapy for, you know, a long time up to that point. So I think really early on, my parents were able to kind of know that there was a problem. and the weight gain was just, you know, part of that. It just, you know, it never stopped at that point in my life, yeah.
Uh-huh. Because it's interesting. I don't know if you heard me talking about the movie Fed Up. But
yeah, I did. I saw it last weekend, actually.
Uh-huh.
I think the, you know, I really enjoyed it, and I think that there's a lot to be, I mean, it's really kind of terrifying watching it. And, you know, and I had, you know, obviously, just because this is, you know, my life and my passion is, you know, food and food addiction and all these different topics. But, you know, it's definitely scary and to see it in your face and have all the facts in front of you. With that said, I really feel like there is a distinction between an eating disorder and that type of food addiction. I mean, it doesn't help the fact that there's all of, you know, the sugars and the addictive qualities to the food that you're eating. But, you know, when I would binge, it wouldn't matter what I was binging on. Like, it was basically anything in front of me I would, you know, put in my mouth. It was my drug. And it came from a more emotional place where I think there is, while there, you know, the sugar and everything is very addictive, and that is an absolute epidemic that is we have to deal with in this world and in this country. There is a difference between an eating disorder and that type of addiction, if I'm making any sense right now.
Yeah, I was wondering about that because, you know, there's something that's that was a little refreshing to take some of the blame off of the individual, you know, because I think, you know, there's a lot of prejudice, and I'm sure you experience this prejudice against fat people.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I remember a class I took where, you know, they were showing pictures, you know, they did a survey with young kids, and they showed, they asked a group of kids, who would you who would you least likely want to be friends with? Who of these pictures would you not want to be friends with? And they showed, you know, a kid that was bald from with chemotherapy, and they showed a black kid, and they showed a Chinese kid, and they showed, a redhead, freckled person, and they showed a fat person, and and across the board, kids didn't want to be friends with the kid that was fat, you know,
right. And
than any other type of kid. It was shocking
Absolutely. To me.
Yeah,
I mean, and, I experienced that firsthand. Sure.
Yeah, and in job market and in rentals, yeah. apartment rentals or whatever. I mean, you know,
yeah.
that's an addiction that you wear on your shirt sleeve. You're not hot.
Absolutely.
You can't hide
and, I mean,
that.
I had an experience when I was at my heaviest weight where my friend was trying to get me a job, and I went on the interview, and the person just completely, you know, degraded and humiliated me and, like, laughed at me and, you know, told me, oh, like, how are you going to even fit into our uniforms? Like, you're too big to be in here, blah, blah. I mean, like, horrific that stuff. I mean, and I had been dealing with, you know, the prejudices against me as far as my weight goes for years at that point, and I just was, like, I couldn't even believe that was actually happening and that was a real thing. And even, I mean, I noticed when I would go, and I talk about that story in my book, and I talk about this in my book as well, but when I would go just to get an application for a job, people would just kind of scoff at me and give me dirty looks and would just, you know, be a little apprehensive about handing me this application. So, like, you know, normal, just retail places and stores and restaurants, like, nobody wanted anything to do with me because of my weight and how I looked. Like,
can you share with my mm-hmm. listeners how heavy you actually got?
My heaviest weight was 312 pounds, and I'm 5'3", so I'm pretty short, so that was
wow.
a lot of weight to be unlucky.
Wow. And where are you now?
I'm about 160.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So you cut yourself in half, basically.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So what was the driving force in you finally deciding to get help? What was the straw that broke the camel's back for you?
Well, I think a big part of it was when I went to college. Because in high school, you know, I was blessed with the fact that I had a really great group of friends who are, you know, continue to be my friends today. And I was really involved in the theater company. So in a school setting, I didn't really deal with that much bullying, you know, definitely not to the level that other kids deal with. Because I, you know, I had, you know, my group of friends. But when I left high school and I went to college, it was really kind of traumatic and eye-opening. I went to school in Manhattan, and I had unfortunately had to commute to school from Long Island, and
what school did you go to?
To the School of Visual Arts.
Uh-huh.
Which, you know, in a sense, you know, like, kids that age are interesting to deal with in the first place. They're not really the nicest, most welcoming people. And I'm sure everyone's, like, you know, excited to be starting this new thing. But it's an art school, and it's, you know, I'm sure
it's
fine.
You have a lot of egos to deal with when you're in art
yeah.
school. I went
yeah,
to art
absolutely.
School, too, so I know it.
Yeah.
I actually went to SUNY Purchase, and, you know,
yeah.
back when it was really starting, and there was the art department, there was the dance department, the theater
mm-hmm.
department, the music department, and
mm-hmm.
it was very selective, and so everybody there thought they were so great. It was really unbelievable.
Yeah.
It was like,
absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
one ego after the next. It was intense.
Yeah, and I mean, that combined with, I mean, because I was a photo major, and like I just completely deteriorated. I was, you know, I'm shy to begin with, and it just, no one was accepting of me or my work. And I only lasted there like 3 months. And I think even before I went to college, I think just the realization that the, you know, the comfort and safety net of these people who I grew up with, and, you know, as much as, you know, any kid doesn't, you know, want to be in school, high school, wherever, it was, you know, leaving that, you know, comfort zone and realizing that I had to kind of start all over in a time when I really didn't know who I was anymore. And I had kind of, by the time I had graduated, I really fell, like, deep into my disorder. Like, I spent most of that summer just in bed, and eating until I blacked out. And so by the time the school year started, I was a mess to begin with. Mm-hmm. So I think once I started school and was dealing with every day, I mean, because every day I would be on the train dealing with people giving me dirty looks and, you know, having, like, almost every day there was a homeless man that would constantly comment on my weight when I would walk past him. And I was just, it was too much for me. And I think, so I'm a very somatic person. So I react by getting sick or in my body to stresses. And I've never purged. I've never, which purging is, you know, would be bulimia when you force yourself to throw up.
Right.
That's never been, something that I've done. But I was all of a sudden throwing up every day, not because I was forcing myself to, but just because my body was, I was just so stressed out, that I started throwing up every day. And at first, you know, we thought, oh, you know, I have a stomach virus, but it just kind of kept going and going. And, I kept finding more excuses to not go to school and to make, you know, reasons to just stay at home and stay in my bed. And I just progressively got more and more into my disorder and more into my depression. And it became really scary.
Debilitating, it sounds like.
Yeah, and really kind of scary for the people around me, like my parents. And I think at that, and for me, I mean, I was not happy in my situation at all. And at that point, I was just, I had two options. I was either going to die or I was going to get help. And I was really aware of that, those being the two options. I had had a suicide attempt before when I was 16. And at this time, my, like, suicidal ideation was just kind of off the charts. And I knew that if I didn't take things into my own hands, that was going to be what ended up happening. I made the decision that I would get help, and I went on medical leave for school. Unfortunately, I ended up falling into, you know, trying to kill myself again, because we had found a treatment center that accepted me. It was for 6 months. It was a long-term treatment center. It was the only place that was dealing with both the mental illness aspect of it and also the obesity and eating disorder aspect of it. Mm-hmm. And I had been accepted right away. We knew this was the place that I was going to go. I was preparing to leave. I was getting excited. And then, you know, treatment is really expensive, so it's nearly impossible unless you're a bajillionaire to pay for these things out of pocket. You have to go through insurance. It's like $1,000 a day or more at most of these places. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we had to go through my insurance company, and I don't think any of us had any idea what we were getting ourselves into, because we just thought, well, you know, I'm clearly very, very sick. I had been in outpatient treatment my entire life up until that point.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing had worked, and I was progressively getting worse and worse. All my doctors and therapists and every specialist was on board, and my insurance company just continuously denied me treatment.
Mm-hmm.
That's
what insurance companies hope do. I mean, they always, you know, the first thing is always to deny, and they hope that they weaken you and that you give up. That's what they hope.
Well,
yes, but you didn't give up, thank God.
Yeah. Well, I did, because unfortunately for them, you know, luckily for me, I didn't die when I tried to kill myself, but because I was just so, they basically shut, like, it was like for the first time a door was being open to my future because I was choosing to get help, and then they just kind of slammed it in my face and then did it over and over and over again because we kept appealing and they just kept denying me. And so I was just like, all right, like, I'm never going to get help. Like, no, I'm hopeless. I'm never going to be able to live my life. At this point, again, like, I didn't have a job. I wasn't in school. I was literally not, like, living in my bed and eating until I blacked out almost every single night. Like, I was stealing money from my parents. I mean, I was a complete drug addict. It's just my drug was food. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it was like, I'm, you know, there was no hope. And so I was done. So I did give up. I mean, I overdosed on my medication because I got to the point that they did cause me to be so weak that I was like, I have no other option. But unfortunately for them, because they that happened, they didn't have any other choice but to grant me treatment. They still didn't grant me the treatment that we had hoped for. Later on down the line, they would, thank God. But I was able to get into an eating disorder treatment facility called the Renfrew Center, which I'm happy that I can actually say that I had changed the names in the hospital, but they've given me permission to use their name. So I was in, they granted me permission to go to the Renfrew Center, and I was there for about a month and a half. But that wouldn't have happened had I not
tried to kill yourself.
Which
unbelievable.
Is disgusting.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It was like I can't even, it's just despicable. It's sad because it happens all the time. And it's
right.
not just with eating disorder, just across the board, but that's a whole other conversation.
Right. Well, it happens, in other situations, too. I mean, my sister, who's a lawyer, worked for a little while for an insurance company, and she couldn't take it. I mean, she did feel like, there were some times where she was able to advocate for someone to get the help they needed,
mm-hmm.
Even though her bosses were saying no, 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 and that made a difference, She was able to... that's how the only way she could reconcile her job until she quit. But it was really tough because she was instructed, no, you say no. You say no first. And so,
right.
Yeah.
It's disgusting. I could go on that for a long time.
Especially for all the money that we pay, right?
Exactly. I mean, that's the whole thing. You're paying for it. It's not free. It's not like you're, asking for free help. Like, you're paying for that.
Right.
It's insurance. It's insurance that when an emergency arises, that you will be taken care of, and we're not.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So anyway, so you got through that. Now, are most of these treatment centers set up to work with eating disorders? Do they focus on binge eating, or are most of them really focused on anorexia and bulimia?
Well, at the time that I had gone into Renfrew, it wasn't. The binge eating disorder was just within the last couple of years put into the DSM, which, and the DSM is the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. It's what they use. Like psychiatrists and therapists and people in that realm use to define mental illnesses and disorders. And at the time, binge eating disorder was not considered an actual eating disorder. They kind of had all different names for it, people, emotional eating and all different things, but it wasn't really considered a disorder. And because of that, most places were not really qualified to treat it. They didn't, and kind of through no fault of their own, because they were, became really good at dealing with bulimia and anorexia and patients of that nature. And I truly believe that at the core, all of these disorders come from the same place. There is definitely a difference in how you need to treat the two. I was before I was in Renfrew, I got sent to another hospital while they were trying to, while my parents and lawyers and everyone were trying to figure out where I was going to go after my suicide attempt. And they, like, and it was an eating disorder hospital, but, I mean, they didn't even have gowns that fit me. Like, it would cover half of my body. I wasn't allowed to move around. Like, I couldn't have any form of exercise. And that kind of was also the same thing when I was in Renfrew with the exercise part. You know, there you have to get to a certain level before you were allowed to be able to do movement. And that's because, you know, a lot of the people with anorexia and bulimia are also use exercise as a form of an eating. That's another, you know, disorder.
Addiction, almost.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. And it was understandable in treatment of those types of disorders. I mean, there were girls on at least in the first place that I was in, where they, you know, were doing, you know, sneaking push-ups and sit-ups in their room. Like, I understand why that was a rule, but it didn't make sense for someone
for you,
who was
right.
morbidly obese,
right.
because my problem, you know, one of the many problems that I had was that I was completely stagnant. Like, I wasn't moving. So in that sense, no, they weren't. And there was only really one group that they had for people with binge eating disorders, and it was actually an outpatient group for women in the community who had gotten gastric bypasses, and they would come, and the people, anyone who was there for binge eating would go and be in on these groups, which didn't really make any sense to me, because I'm like, well, I can't really relate to a person who's gotten a gastric bypass. Like, I'm
right,
feeling,
right.
This is completely different.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, people just didn't know. Like, people just didn't know how to deal with it. But on the other side of things, because at the core of all of the eating disorders, it's really coming from the same place. And I would, you know, branch out even to say addiction, like most addictions, the therapeutic aspect of it was incredible. I mean, it completely changed my life. I would recommend the Renfrew Center to anyone. I mean, they have a really comprehensive, like, holistic view on how to deal with these disorders. So there was all different forms of therapies that for, you know, for the first time in my life, I was able to kind of, you know, deal with the abuses, actually start to kind of create a relationship with my body, have more of an understanding of what, you know, at the root of what was happening to me. It's also an all-women's facility, which I think at that time was
important for me.
Yeah.
Sure. I want to get more into, you know, what was the turning point for you, like in really the healing process. But before we do that, we're going to take a couple-minute break.
Sure.
And when we come back, then let's talk about that, okay?
Okay, great.
Everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Sarah Romeo White, who came out with Binge My Story. And you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And we'll be right back. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Sarah Romeo White, writer, blogger, and author of BingeMyStory.com, where she shares her memoir of struggling with her binge eating disorder. And Sarah, are you with us?
Yes, hi.
Great, welcome back. So when we took our break, you were just, you know, sharing with us your treatment. Where is that center, the Ren Center?
The Renfrew Center is all over. I believe it's only on the East Coast, but I could be wrong. The inpatient facility that I was in Florida. They have another inpatient facility in Philadelphia, and then they have other outpatient facilities. I know they have one in New York, New Jersey, and then also are all other places as well.
Right.
I'm just not sure.
Okay,
where.
So you said you were there for like a month, but that wasn't the final
no,
place
yeah.
for you where you got your
yeah.
that was the beginning of your help, but
yeah.
Where did you end up going after that? Because
mm-hmm.
I don't want to rush us, but I want to get most of the story in, and we only have about 10 minutes left.
Sure, no problem. Well, when I came home from the Rutgers Center, I mean, I needed long-term treatment, and that's why we had fought for me to get long-term treatment, and Renfrew was not long-term. And when I came home, I relapsed pretty immediately. So it wasn't long before we started fighting again to get me into the hospital. And I was in another hospital, which I'm not going to name right now. And I was in that hospital for 6 months. It was a little bit of a crazy environment. A lot of the people who were there were court ordered to be there. So it didn't really have the therapeutic and kind of like lush, beautiful atmosphere that, Renfrew did, and like amazing community of people. It was really kind of a scary place.
It felt more like an institutional hospital.
Yeah, and I had been in mental hospitals before, and this was definitely more on that line. Not even really like a psychiatric ward, but more like a home for kids who, you know, had gone through the system and didn't really have any other choice of where else to go.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's kind of, this is like the last resort of where, you know, the judges sent them before going to, instead of, or in lieu of going to juvie, at least for
mm-hmm.
some of them, not for all of them. You know, I wasn't the only person there who wasn't court ordered, but I was one of few. And, you know, while the environment was, you know, pretty toxic and scary, they really understood the nutrition aspect of it, and they were really able to help me. First of all, I lost a lot of weight while I was there, which was really, you know, it's really important for someone who is morbidly obese. Like, you have to deal with both things. And the other thing,
did you not lose a lot of weight at the other treatment center? I mean, you were only there a month, but.
Well, I didn't lose any weight. I think I may have even gained.
Oh, really?
Weight. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, and that was, again, it's part of, you know, how do you, when there's like three people in a community dealing with one disorder and the rest of the community is dealing with a disorder that is kind of on the opposite end of, well, it is on the opposite end of the spectrum. Like, how do you manage that when you're not prepared to at that point? But again,
uh-huh.
you know, I'm sure that they are today, because things are different now than they were, you know, that long ago. So I learned a lot about nutrition. I was really lucky. I had a really incredible treatment team there. So as much as I can, you know, talk smack about the environment or anything like that, I really had an incredible team of people who were taking care of me and helping me. My therapist there was probably, to this day, the best therapist that I've ever had, and the dietitian there was really amazing, and you know, became kind of a friend to me, and kind of took me under her wing and really helped me and taught me a lot about nutrition and how to really continue to work the program that they had when I got home. And the other thing I was saying is that it's one of the differences between, you know, binge eating and bulimia and anorexia is that, well, you know, maybe it's not different, because it is really important for someone who's anorexic or bulimic to gain weight in a safe place. And in that same respect, it's really important for someone who's dealing with a binge eating disorder, especially someone who is morbidly obese, because not everyone who has a binge eating disorder is overweight. But if you are, like, it's really important to be in a safe place when you're losing the weight, because part of putting that weight on and continuously putting that weight on is, you know, you're creating a shield for yourself. Like, there's something,
right.
You know, I was terrified of life and the world and people around me and being, you know, desired in any way or attractive in any way, and my weight was my shield. Right. And anytime
did anyone
that I
ever
watched,
give you the book Fat? It's a Feminist Issue. Did you ever see
no,
that book?
I'm sure yeah. my mom has it somewhere, but I don't know.
Well, I know because you know I've always struggled with my weight. You know, I was one of four kids, and I was the chubby one. You know, mm-hmm. from day one, you know, and all any of my siblings had to do was call me fatso, and, you know, I'd break down mm-hmm. crying, and I'd beat them up, and, you know,
right.
I mean, it was just, yeah. you know, so I understand, you know, and I've, you know, and I've been to Weight Watchers, you know, I understand the lifelong struggle that it has, and even as a natural food chef and all the good food I eat, you know, I still take in too many calories for what I burn. I mean, it's just, you know,
right.
You know,
yeah.
that's what it is. And my body burns slower than someone else's body. I don't necessarily eat that much more than somebody else. But that's my body. And, you know, so I understand, you know, I had some of the emotional, not to the extent that you did, but, mm-hmm. you know, being called fatso was, you know, something that was in my history as well. So.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and it definitely, that's a trigger. you
yeah.
know.
Yeah.
You know, I think that is something, back to just what I was saying with the losing weight in a safe place, I think that that's a really important aspect that treatment centers and insurance companies and, you know, places that are providing the treatment need to really understand.
So in this last place, this is where did you lose all your weight while you were there in that 6 months?
No, I lost 80 pounds while I was there, and then when I came home, because this is the other issue with most treatment places, is that, you know, you're in this place for 6 months or however long, and you're in this fake world, like it's not real life, and it's important that you're not in real life when you're dealing with this stuff,
mm-hmm.
but then when you go home, it's just like culture shock. I mean, you have to relearn how to speak to people because the conversations that you're having in a hospital are different than the conversations that you're having at home. Like, I'm not mm-hmm. going to be able to go, you know, meet someone and, you know, tell them my life history. Like, it's very different. And being around a refrigerator and being able to be, you know, my car for me was a really big trigger because I used to binge a lot in my car. So like having my car and having it stuff it's, you know, it's really hard to reintegrate into society after that.
Uh-huh.
And so I relapsed again. But what was the biggest turning point for me was, because I had proven time and time again, because I'd been in and out of hospital since I was 16, that I work really well in a structured environment.
Uh-huh.
I hadn't figured out how to recreate that in my life at home, because when I was at home, or when I was, you know, not just at home, but just in my life, I was just too filled up with all of my own, you know, emotional stuff and everything that I, you know, it was impossible for me to find structure because I was too sick.
So how did you create that for yourself?
Mm-hmm. So I created that for myself. Because I had to get a job, and I got hired at Starbucks, and it saved my life. I mean, I could have easily relapsed again and, you know, fallen into the same pattern. But I relapsed, I got this job, and for the first time, I was really being able to, prove to myself, which is the most important thing, but and then also to the people around me that I was able to live up to responsibilities, and learn work ethic, which I hadn't done before. I mean, I almost didn't graduate high school because I hadn't done that before.
Right.
My emotions were, like, the most important thing to me. Once I started to do that, and I, you know, very quickly we got promoted there because I really was like, wow, like, this is some, it's a, maybe menial tasks, but these are menial tasks that I'm able to finish and,
right.
and do and, like, be good at. And so there's a specific night that I can think of where everything just kind of switched, you know, and it's a little difficult to, you know, when people ask, like, what was the moment when you decided that
why don't you do this, since we're just mm-hmm. about out of time, instead of telling
sure.
us, why don't you share with people where they can find it in Binge My Story, so people go to your to your story, and they have to find the end out there themselves.
Okay, sure. I am not sure exactly which chapter that's in, but read the whole thing.
Yes, they should read the whole thing. It's so great.
Yes, thank you. It's bingemystory.com. And I will, and I do go deep into how my recovery and healing process. And just on a note before we end, you know, to understand that it's never ending. You know, this is a daily. This will be my life. You know, my whole life will always be me. I need to check in with myself, and I need to take care of myself, and I need to do that in a way that maybe other people don't have to.
Right. And it's the same with all addictions, whether it's alcohol or drugs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a struggle. And I just want to admire you and thank you for sharing it, because I know it's hard. You know, like I said, you wear it on your shirt sleeve, and it's, you know, it's emotional and it's hard. And coming out with it really will help other people. So thank you, Sarah, for sharing it.
Yeah, that's my intention. I just want to be able to help other people, because I know so many people are struggling with it.
It will, and they're struggling in secret. So thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And everybody out there, have a great rest of the week. I wish we had more time. I could talk with Sarah for another hour easily. I'll be with you all again next week. Have a great rest of the week. Bye for now.